2,400 of those killed are eight Sikhs targeted at the so-called eight distribution centres. Let us now cross over to Deir al-Balah and talk to Muti Abu Musabib on the ground. Muti, over to you. Tell us what are happening and what are the latest developments in the region.
Well, unfortunately, the situation in Gaza is still getting worse and worse under the inferno of the genocidal attacks that the Israeli occupation forces are still launching against various parts of Gaza Strip. And as you know, those attacks are still concentrated on Gaza City. The Israeli warplanes are still obliterating different parts of the city. And since then, I was still just a moment, we are talking about at least 30 consecutive strikes have been launched and carried out against multi-floor residential buildings, particularly in Ashara refugee camp. Multi-floor residential buildings, high-rise buildings being targeted and destroyed by those Israeli fighter jets. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces proceeded to destroy at least three schools that were taking shelter by the space Palestinians in that area. And as you know, we are talking about a massive and staggering scale of destruction unfolding right now in those areas. And according to multiple eyewitnesses in Gaza City, the Israeli regime and the Israeli occupation forces are using new missiles with unprecedented destructive power. And this is very apparent and obvious in terms of the unprecedented scale of destruction left behind those attacks. And we understand clearly that with every Israeli strike targets and hits any area or any residential building in Gaza City, we are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian families that become completely shelterless and homeless. Those people are suffering severely right now because, as you know, there are no spaces available for them because the western sides of Gaza City and the coastal area of Gaza City is still overcrowded with hundreds of thousands of Palestinian families. Those areas are flooded with the makeshift tents. This is why those Palestinian people who become recently, as you know, homeless, they do not have any spaces available for them. In addition to that, those people are still suffering from the lack of the basic humanitarian essentials, including the food items, the drinkable water, in addition to the proper shelters they need in order to shelter and in order to survive the kind of circumstances. So we are talking about an unprecedented situation. The Israeli regime is still creating in Gaza City in particular. And definitely the Israeli forces are still ongoing with their rural areas. Strikes and attacks. We are talking about more and ceaseless Israeli strikes and attacks. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground are still detonating more booby-trapped robots against multiple residential squares and buildings. So what they are doing on the ground is, as you know, systematically targeting Palestinian residential buildings and pushing the Palestinian people to evacuate their residential areas.
Right, thank you so much, Muti. For the update, Muti Abu Musabib on the ground in Deir al-Balah. Former Israeli military chief Herzi Halevi has confirmed that over 200,000 Palestinians in Gaza, more than 10% of its population, have been killed or injured since the genocide began in October 2023. The figure aligns with data from Gaza's health ministry. Despite Israeli claims of bias, the figure is considered credible by international humanitarian organizations. Leaked Israeli intelligence indicates that over 80% of those killed were civilians. Halevi said Israel took the gloves off from the first minute. He expressed regret that the regime didn't do this earlier. He suggested that Israel should have adopted a harsher stance prior to the October 7th attacks. Halevi also led the Israeli forces for 17 months and stepped down in March. The United Nations has voiced concern about the Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank, saying the settlements are, quote, maintained and established against international law. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric called on the regime to cease all settlement activities, and he said such moves further entrench occupation and systematically erode the viability of a Palestinian state. Dujarric made the comment in response to a question regarding Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent decision to ratify plans for the E1 settlement project. Netanyahu has claimed Israel will allow no Palestinian state to exist or to be established. The E1 project effectively cuts much of the West Bank off from Al-Quds. The Yemeni army has launched yet another anti-Israeli operation in support of the Palestinian people, striking vital targets in the occupied territories.
The missile unit of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a military operation using the Fission multi-warhead hypersonic ballistic missile, Palestine 2, and struck several sensitive targets in the occupied Jaffa area.
The spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces said the operation successfully achieved its objectives and prompted widespread evacuations across Israeli settlements. Sari stated that the strikes were carried out in response to the genocide and starvation crimes committed by Israel in the Gaza Strip. He reaffirmed that Yemen would continue its support for Gaza regardless of the consequences. Activist and political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti joined us earlier from the capital Sana'a to offer his insight into Yemen's latest military operation against Israel.
Spokesperson of Yemeni army have said that Yemeni has targeted areas in Yafa, sensitive site for the Zionist state of Israel, using hypersonic ballistic missiles with, this is a new type of missile that comes with the cluster warhead or several warhead, and actually those type of missiles, they are really difficult to shoot down. Even though if you shoot down these missiles, they will separate in many other warhead, and it's difficult to hit them. And there's a clear message that Yemeni, I believe at this time, this is the fifth or the fourth time they use this type of missile, and I believe that they're gonna widespread using those missiles against the Zionist state of Israel. And this is as well a clear message to the Zionists. Those type of attack that Yemeni has conducted in the last few hours, it shows that Yemeni, actually their military installation is intact, and the only thing that the Zionists actually successful and good at is killing and targeting civilians. It's exactly the same thing they are doing in Gaza. Yemen is almost one of the almost the only country that got involved in a war and target Israel and begin war against Israel because of its genocide in Gaza, and their demand is simple: lift the blockade, stop the killing of Palestinian people, and Yemeni will stop. We have seen that Yemeni has been successful in blocking the Red Sea, in closing Umm Rashrash or Eilat port south of occupied Palestine, and they focus their attack as well on airport in the Zionist state of Israel, like Ben-Gurion Airport.
Tens of thousands of people have joined a rally in New Zealand to show their support for Palestinians and to denounce the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. At least 50,000 people poured into the streets of Auckland to join the March for Humanity. Organizers say it's the largest pro-Palestine rally ever held in the country. Demonstrators waved Palestinian flags and held placards calling for an end to forced starvation, displacement and genocide in Gaza. They also condemned their government's inaction in the face of Israeli atrocities. Protesters called on the government to hold the regime accountable for its UN-documented war crimes against Palestinians. Just 10 days before the UN General Assembly is set to start, protesters in New York demonstrated against the continuous genocide in Gaza, now nearing 2 years. Our correspondent Rachel Hamdoun has more on the story.
Refusal of the continuous genocide in Gaza by the Israeli occupation, many took to the streets of New York City to condemn the relentless and open-field bombing campaigns that have now left nearly 65,000 killed. Protesters held banners calling for the freedom of Palestine and the end of the forced starvation of its people as they marched the busy streets chanting for an end to the occupation by Israeli forces.
To tell the world that this is a complete hypocrisy because they want to uphold international laws for other people, but when it comes to Gaza, absolutely no response. And we deserve to be treated like normal human beings, just like every other person, and everybody deserves basic human rights.
Protesters are demanding that the Israeli occupation be sanctioned and an arms embargo be put in place, especially after the IOF has called for the evacuation of Gaza under the guise of so-called safe zones. This comes after the genocide is nearing 2 years, and the people of New York are saying, and they demand, an immediate ceasefire. Appraisals were heard among the crowd for the global Sumud flotilla, which Israel has already attacked in Tunisia, as a flock of boats made their way to Gaza to break the imposed siege, while some protesters expressed hope in persevering until the siege is broken.
We have reached the point where Israel has turned the world into such a place where those who try to bring food are treated as criminals, while those who try to bring sieges are treated as villains. And while those who orchestrate and lead genocides like Benjamin Netanyahu are treated with respect, are welcomed into the halls of international diplomacy.
With the UN General Assembly approaching in a week, people are already preparing to protest war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu's arrival to New York, while the international community continues to stay silent. Rachel Hamdoun, New York.
A new collection of short films from Gaza has gone on the silver screen in London. For from Ground Zero brings together 22 works created under relentless Israeli bombardment, giving audiences a rare glimpse of everyday life in the besieged territory. More now from Said Pereza.
At London's Genesis Cinema, a packed hall watches From Ground Zero, a series of 22 short films by as many directors, spanning fiction, documentary, and animation. Made by young filmmakers inside Gaza as the Israeli genocide unfolds, the collection captures fragments of daily life in the territory.
For so many years, I was making Palestinian stories into cinema and showing them all over the world. For sure, when something like this happening, I need to share these stories with the world. I need to show what's going on in the small details of their life, far from the news.
One film shows the effects of Israel's starvation campaign. Another, musicians and vocalists refusing to surrender joy. And another, a husband remembering his last phone call to his wife and children before they were killed by Israel. Together, they show audiences the devastation, the heartache, and the determination of a people who continue to create.
The message I kind of take with me is that the children, no matter how much they're suffering, they are still able to tell stories of hope and to get over this. And I think within the sadness of it all, losing people, losing your home and everything, your identity, your being a Palestinian is what keeps them going.
I felt closer to the people that are actually in Palestine, especially because we actually heard names. So it's not just numbers. And I think it's very important to people know the actual names of the people that are there.
The films have already been shown at international festivals to rapturous applause.
The screening feels like more than cinema. It is a reminder that storytelling is an act of survival, with the directors insisting that their voices be heard. For the Palestinian diaspora, this is a bridge. For others, a chance to witness lives that are often reduced to headlines, demonized and dehumanized.
Supported by award-winning American director Michael Moore, From Ground Zero offers no easy answers, but it proves that even in the harshest of circumstances, art endures. Said Pereza, London.
China has deployed its newest and most advanced aircraft carrier to the South China Sea. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the Fujian carrier was deployed through the Taiwan Strait to conduct scientific research and training missions. It said the mission is not directed at any specific target and constitutes a routine part of the carrier's construction process. Earlier, Chinese Taipei's Defense Ministry reported that it's been monitoring the situation and has taken appropriate measures. China considers Chinese Taipei as part of its territory, which has been separated since the end of the Civil War in 1949. The Fujian's passage through the sensitive Taiwan Strait underscores Beijing's growing military and maritime power. The country now maintains the world's largest naval fleet, with a battle force of more than 370 ships and submarines. Moscow says it is not expecting the peace talks at Kyiv to yield immediate results, adding the negotiations are paused for now. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says negotiators still have the opportunity to communicate through existing channels, but he warned that one can't wear rose-tinted glasses on the subject. Russia has recently ratcheted up its offensive in Ukraine, slowly capturing more Ukrainian territory. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said the war will not end unless its root causes are addressed. Russia said at the beginning of the war that it will not allow NATO military presence near its borders.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
My life has been a journey where faith is where I roam. But steps I used to walk in don't really match mine no more. I live south for the river where children are quick to grow. Walking down the street full of distraction for some they call it home. So take me home.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam to you, dear brother, dear sister, in faith and humanity. So welcome, you are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, which in this program we're going to speak about turning setbacks into success. So be with us. But first, as the ritual of this program, we'll look at the calendar. Today is Saturday, 20th of the month of Rabiul Awwal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 22nd of the month of Shahrivar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 13th of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's start with the Holy Quran. For today, we'll listen to verse 7 of chapter Asra.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. In أحسنتم أحسنتم لأنفسكم وإن أسأتم فلها فإذا جاء وعد الآخرة ليسوءوا وجوهكم وليدخلوا المسجد كما دخلوه أول مرة وليتبروا ما علوا تتبيرا.
And said, if you do good, you do good for yourselves, and if you do evil, you do it to yourselves. Then when the final promise came, we sent your enemies to sadden your faces and to enter the temple in Jerusalem, as they entered it the first time, and to destroy what they had taken over with total destruction.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
This is a general and everlasting rule that all good and evil will eventually return to one's own self. However, it is with deep regret that neither the punishment of Allah may awaken you, nor this favor and renewed divine grace, for you turn to rebellion once again, following the path of tyranny, oppression, and violation, inciting a grave corruption on the earth and exceeding the limits in arrogance and self-superiority.
Us the words of Allah, mercy and kindness and hope for everyone. Peace be upon you, O Muhammad.
As I told you at the beginning of this episode of today's special, we're going to speak about turning setbacks into success. Embracing failure can seem counterintuitive, especially in a society that often places a high value on perfection and success. However, failure is a natural and inevitable part of life, and it can actually be a valuable opportunity for learning and growth. When we embrace failure and view it as a temporary setback rather than a personal defeat, we open ourselves up to new possibilities and perspectives. By seeking feedback and learning from our mistakes, we can turn failure into success and build resilience in the face of future challenges. It's important to remember that failure is a normal and necessary part of the journey towards success. And adopting a growth mindset can help us to see each failure as an opportunity to improve and move forward.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. Today we are going to talk about how to turn failure into success. It means, if we want to interpret or translate it into another word, it means that how can we change the threats into opportunities, right? So we can take some lessons from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. What happens when we rely on God? This is a first question that we want to ask ourselves with. Life is fraught with difficulties and stress. Nothing seems to go the way we planned, and obstacles spring up no matter how well we thought out our steps to success. One of the biggest mistakes we make is that we make is to not take advice. Believe it or not, others have been there and found ways to navigate the road to success. whether the road is in this world or in the hereafter. Brendan Bercher, the motivated speaker and author, offers us several ways to turn failure into success and defeat into motivation, as ideas are based around the fact that people, no matter what their circumstances, need to be grateful and need to give back to the world through service. Almost 1500 years ago, another man taught something very similar, and we can use Burchard's motivational words to ponder the advice we were given by this man, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the infallibles, lessons from the life of the infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
Now let's look at the benefits of failure in this episode of today's special. The one quality that differentiates those who succeed from those who don't is the mental strength and fearless ability to persevere. Whatever the outcome, using failure to your advantage requires mental strength, and experiencing failure helps build this quality. Bouncing back from failure makes you stronger and more resilient to future failures. The more times you are unsuccessful will help you develop the ability to bounce back quickly and find new solutions to make your next attempt successful. Your create an inner resolve, tenacity, and a fearless determination to not fail again. This is probably one of the most important benefits of failure.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone in life.
Now, ways to turning failure into success. That one of the ways is giving up or try again. Did you really want it in the first place? Is it because we failed that we decided to change our goals? However, if you really don't have a reason on why you want to succeed, then failure will be catastrophic. At times, you just need to avoid it if you are not sure you really want to go into it in the first place. On the other hand, if you have a strong enough reason to succeed, then failure won't be an obstacle. You will be able to overcome anything that comes your way. This means you are supposed to come up with a good reason for succeeding in something. This is the first step in overcoming failure in what you do. With that belief, you will always have to try again, because failure to you will just be feedback.
Think that if you want to be a successful Muslim, you isolate yourself. Islam does not believe in isolation, and that you go and you become monks or isolate yourselves in your homes. No. Islam, half of it is theoretical knowledge at the theoretical level, Half of it is implementing that knowledge in society. So if you have that knowledge, but you lock yourself up in a room, and you don't go out there in society every single day, deal with people, then you're not worshiping God the way He wants you. If you isolate yourself, you have failed to understand Islam. Because Islam wants you to be active in your community. That's part of Islam. Do business with people, deal with people, help people, have social relations. That's the biggest challenge, really. The most successful person is the one who maintains positive social relations with people, yet observes the boundaries of Allah. This person is the greatest worshiper in the eyes of God. Not the person who locks himself up in his house and worships God. That's not a big achievement. Anybody could do that, stay home and worship God. The real achievement is to go out there in society, in the workplace, and observe the laws of God. That's tough. But that's the highest form of worship. The imam is not saying this person is going to hell and Allah will not accept for him. No, no, no. But that's the lowest type of faith. You want the higher types of faith? You want to really understand Islam? Go out there in society. Be active in society. Yet, observe the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and be positive with all people.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah, we'll meet you soon. Till then, fi amanillah.
They told me that I'm crazy, who you praying for? They told me there is nothing, who you looking for? Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were like, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. Exactly 43 years ago, in August 1982, the Arab world experienced one of the most devastating defeats in its modern history. Although it is not often remembered as a crushing military defeat, its repercussions created a significant turning point. The Israeli army occupied the entire southern region of Lebanon, vast areas of Mount Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley, ultimately concluding its advance with the capture of Beirut, the Lebanese capital, after a prolonged siege of its western neighborhoods. The siege resulted in the destruction of much of the city. The scenes we're witnessing in Gaza today, during 2023, 2024, and 2025, mirror those that occurred in Beirut in 1982. Back then, the neighborhoods of the capital were relentlessly bombarded, day and night, as projectiles and bombs fell like an unending rain. Hunger spread among the population, and the city was plunged into darkness, lacking electricity and water. Beirut, ravaged by fire and destruction, literally burned under the Israeli advance. Even before the siege, within just a few days, the Israeli army had occupied nearly a third of Lebanese territory, advancing right up to the capital. After the siege, Israel achieved most of its strategic objectives. It expelled the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from Lebanon and forced the Syrian army to withdraw from Beirut and the southern part of Mount Lebanon. Despite the historic battles fought by units of the Syrian army, as well as by Lebanese and Palestinian groups, the defeat was overwhelming. Politically, the Israeli victory was solidified by the election of Bashir Gemayel, its main ally in Lebanon, and president of the republic. In a private interview with one of the fighters who resisted the Israeli invasion and was injured during the clashes in Beirut, I asked him about his reaction to the occupation of the capital. His response mirrored the mood of many Lebanese at that time. After Gemayel's election, he decided to leave Lebanon for good and requested the leaders of the Lebanese Communist Party to arrange a scholarship for him abroad in order to continue his studies. This gesture, more than an individual act, symbolized the collective despair. It was ultimately a reflection of a comprehensive defeat. However, fate took an unexpected turn. Days later, Bashir Gemayel was assassinated in Beirut just before he was set to assume the presidency. In light of this event, the very fighter who had planned to leave tore up his passport and chose to remain in Lebanon, dedicated to continuing the fight against the occupation. In this episode, we will delve deeply into the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, focusing our attention on the occupation of Beirut following its siege and destruction. We will explore the dimensions of this total defeat and demonstrate how the victory achieved by the occupying entity extended beyond Gemayel's election in 1982, with its effects manifesting 11 years later in different contexts. Our aim is not merely to archive or document these events for history, but to extract the lessons and insights that are crucial for understanding our present and envisioning our future. In the early hours of June 6, 1982, the large-scale Israeli invasion of Lebanon began. Tens of thousands of soldiers and officers crossed the border from Palestine, organized into multiple divisions that advanced simultaneously on three main fronts, with a clear goal to occupy Lebanon. While the attack caught many off guard in its execution, it was not an unprecedented event. Most of the Lebanese population, along with regional political observers, had already foreseen an imminent invasion. However, estimates regarding the exact timing and scale of the advance varied widely. Within hours, the Lebanese landscape was split into two parallel realities that would essentially capture the drama of what would later be known as the 1982 invasion, or from the Israeli viewpoint, the First Lebanon War. The first scene that marked the early days of the invasion was that of Israeli tanks advancing unopposed along the Lebanese coast, from Naqoura in the far south to the gates of Beirut. They did the rhythm of Boker Tov Lebanon, or Good Morning Lebanon. In just 3 days, from June 6th to June 9th, 1982, Israeli forces besieged the Palestinian camps in Tyre and Sidon in southern Lebanon, executed strategic landings and flanking maneuvers, and reached the outskirts of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. By then, nearly half of the Lebanese coast was already under Israeli control. This rapid advance and the arrival of troops at the outskirts of Beirut caused a great shock. Questions multiplied. What had gone wrong in the defensive preparations? What was the true capacity for resistance, given that the invasion, although anticipated, unfolded with such speed and effectiveness? However, in another equally revealing scene, a radically different perspective emerged. At the Burj al Shamali camp near the city of Tyre in southern Lebanon, the commander of the central sector of Fatah movement, known as Bilal al-Awsat, reorganized the remaining fighters to confront the Israeli siege. By noon on Sunday, June 6, just hours after the invasion began, and as Israeli tanks approached the camp's entrances, the Fedayeen set up strategic ambushes. According to Israeli sources, these actions destroyed at least five tanks and led to the capture of four soldiers in the early hours of the fighting. For 48 hours, the defenders managed to hold back the Israeli assault on the camp. Faced with the inability to advance, the occupying forces opted for a change in tactics. They withdrew the tanks and unleashed a series of violent airstrikes against shelters and schools, committing horrific massacres that forced the Fedayeens to retreat to other areas. Testimonies from various surviving Fedayeens gathered by Palestinian historian Jaber Suleiman recount that the fighters left the camp taking the Zionist prisoners with them to a nearby forest close to the village of Halusieh, alongside the Litani River north of Tyre. Suleiman shares the account of one of the Fedayeens, who stated, "We slept during the day and walked at night. We arrived in Halusieh by the Litani River, where about 600 fighters gathered. The residents of Halusieh and Zeraria provided us with food, transported by donkeys, bread, rice, and meat. Among us were fighters from those two villages. From there, some groups moved to Wadi Jahannam at the foot of Zeraria, and we traveled at night until we reached Babylia near Zahrani. While we were in Babylia, we heard on the radio a statement from a leader of Fatah announcing the end of armed resistance, stating that the struggle had shifted to a political one. After the dismantling of the camp and the withdrawal of numerous field commanders to Beirut and the Bekaa, to the east and northeast of Lebanon, Bilal al-Awsat chose to stay in the south. There he continued to resist the invasion until he disappeared, months after it began. The story of the Burj al-Shamali camp and other resistance strongholds in the south unfolded while the entire world watched the advance of Israeli tanks on the outskirts of Beirut. This narrative, along with that of Bilal al-Awsat and many other Lebanese and Palestinian Fedayeen, some of whom remain missing, highlights the tremendous sacrifices made by those who fought until the last bullet. All of this took place against the backdrop of political statements pointing towards a negotiated political solution and suggesting the abandonment of armed struggle as a means for the liberation of Palestine. These stories, along with these two seemingly contradictory scenes, illustrate recurring examples of the same narrative, the 1982 invasion. It's the story of a war that witnessed the paradoxical coexistence of two realities that under normal circumstances rarely converge, the world of defeat and the world of victory. The story of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon didn't start with a sudden attack. Its roots can be traced back, in part, to the assassination attempt on the Israeli ambassador in Great Britain on June 3, 1982. However, the Israeli plan to invade Lebanon and occupy Beirut was developed following the earlier invasion of 1978, known as Operation Litani, which lasted for 7 days. During this operation, the Israeli army advanced to the Litani River and occupied parts of the southern region of the country. At that time, the Israeli enemy established what was called a buffer zone in collaboration with a group of local agents in the area. Although Operation Litani ended with tactical achievements for the enemy, the Israeli military and security mindset continued to plan the next move. According to a detailed analysis of official Israeli documents, the design for the invasion of Lebanon and the occupation of Beirut, the then Israeli War Minister, Ezer Weizman, stated that the goal of the next war would be to eliminate the power of the saboteurs in Lebanon. And he added that Israel would aim to establish a government in Beirut that aligns with its interests. According to the same study, the Israeli War Minister Ariel Sharon, who succeeded Wiseman and Menachem Begin, personally developed the invasion plan and presented it to the General Staff in October 1981. During the discussions, three main objectives for the operation were defined. Expel the PLO factions from Lebanon, withdraw the Syrian army from Beirut, and facilitate the establishment of a government favorable to Israel in Beirut. According to the study, excerpts of which were published by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in 2014, the political objectives of the invasion were remarkably explicit, as Ariel Sharon outlined them to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In his own words, the physical destruction of the PLO goes beyond simply seeking peace in northern Galilee. It encompasses the potential to engage in dialogue with the Palestinian population in the territories we control. Negotiating with them is impossible while they're under the influence of armed organizations. As long as the PLO leaders and between 10,000 and 20,000 of their fighters remain in Lebanon, we will not be able to reach any agreement with the Arabs of Judea and Samaria, occupied West Bank, to implement an autonomy plan. In essence, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 was not limited to military objectives related to the security of northern settlements. Its ambition was much deeper, to leverage military success to reshape the internal dynamics of Palestinian society and impose Palestinian self-governance in the West Bank. Contrary to the narrative that the Israeli plan was restricted to an occupation of merely 40 kilometers of Lebanese territory, or that Sharon acted unilaterally in deceiving Prime Minister Menachem Begin, the Israeli government, and even the United States, recent documents from the book 1982, Lebanon and the Road to War, by Israeli historian Gal Kipnis, reveal that Begin was not a victim of deception. On the contrary, he was one of the main proponents of the occupation of Beirut and the restructuring of the Lebanese political system. From the Israeli perspective, the invasion of Lebanon was a carefully crafted strategy. Its aim was not just to neutralize the threat posed by the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Lebanese nationalist forces in the northern settlements of Palestine, but also to redefine the regional balance. To achieve this, the plan was to establish a pro-Israeli regime in Beirut, using Lebanon as a platform to reshape the geopolitical landscape.
عبر تأسيس نظام حكم موالي لإسرائيل ببيروت
To analyze the circumstances surrounding the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, it's crucial to contextualize the regional landscape of that time. No political event in Lebanon can be interpreted in isolation. Rather, it must be understood as part of a broader regional framework. The most significant regional event that influenced the process leading to the invasion of Lebanon was the signing of the Camp David Accords, the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, signed in 1978. According to a former Israeli intelligence officer, Shlomo Gazit, every victory achieved by Israel in Lebanon has its roots in the peace agreement with Egypt. This agreement not only represented a milestone in its own right, but it was also tested at two critical moments. First, during the limited invasion of southern Lebanon in March 1978, prior to its signing, and later, after its ratification, with the large-scale invasion of Lebanon in 1982. The Camp David Accords, which emerged after the 1973 war and were solidified by Anwar Sadat's visit to Al-Quds in 1977, provided Israel with two fundamental strategic advantages. These advantages, in turn, expanded Israel's operational flexibility to initiate a war against Lebanon. First, the Camp David Accords allowed for the redeployment of tens of thousands of Israeli soldiers and officers from the southern front of occupied Palestine to the north. This movement enabled the execution of invasion plans for Lebanon with greater efficiency and military resources. Secondly, and as the most significant consequence, the normalization of relations between Anwar Sadat and Israel spurred a shift in the Arab political discourse. What was once almost unanimous support for the Palestinian cause and its rights evolved into a stance that demanded recognition of Israel's legitimacy and the pursuit of negotiated solutions. This political shift had a direct impact on the direction of the Palestine Liberation Organization, which in 1974, less than a year after Egypt began its realignment, approved the 10-point program. This document laid the groundwork for future negotiations between the PLO and Israel, a process that would culminate decades later with the Oslo Accords in 1993. When evaluating the regional context and the influence of the Camp David Accords on Israel's decision to invade Lebanon, it's also crucial to consider the first Saudi peace initiative with Israel, presented in 1981 by then Crown Prince Fahd bin Abdulaziz. The initiative marked a historic milestone, the Arab recognition of Israel's existence. This radical shift in the regional stance had immediate consequences. After Egypt withdrew from the political scene, Syria found itself isolated, confronted with a new Arab narrative advocating for normalization with Israel. Thus, Damascus stood alone alongside Palestinian and Lebanese forces in an asymmetric confrontation against Israeli power and American hegemony. Ultimately, the Camp David Accords and later the initiative by Prince Fahd signaled the beginning of a series of events that led to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. The epicenter of this transformation was a conflict that was already shaking the region, the Lebanese Civil War, which began in 1975. In 1982, the Lebanese Civil War was entering its seventh year. Without delving into the specifics of the conflict, the internal situation of the country and the involved parties could be summarized by the famous words of Ziad Rahbani. The situation has become complicated and the bombs have started to fall. In this context, the factions of the Palestine Liberation Organization were at a political and military crossroads. On the one hand, they were engaged in a fierce internal war on Lebanese soil. On the other hand, they were conducting active operations against the Israeli occupation in southern Lebanon and behind enemy lines, along with external actions targeting Israel's interests and allies, which further intensified the conflict. Amidst this scenario, some leaders within the PLO had expressed since 1974 their willingness to seek a peaceful solution, as previously mentioned. This stance led to internal divisions within the Palestinian movement, particularly regarding the consistency and commitment of the leadership to the National Liberation Project. At the same time, the rise of sectarian violence in Lebanon, with identity-based killings and confessional massacres, intensified the pressure on the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Lebanese nationalist forces in the country. By reconstructing this landscape from the Israeli perspective and its regional strategy to the internal dynamics in Lebanon, a clear picture of the reality leading up to June 6, 1982, emerges. On that day, the outbreak of war shattered the fragile existing balance, ushering in a new historical phase where victory and defeat intertwined in a paradoxical and complex manner.
This is Iran Radio, and we have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Chapter Al-Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. This chapter, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions too. Now we listen to the translation of this holy chapter. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. And now the continuation of the programs. You are listening to Iran Radio. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, the events of September 11, 2001 set in motion sweeping changes to U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism practices.